Welcome to the Soccer Central Podcast.
Good day there, football fans, and yes, indeed, welcome to the Soccer Central Podcast. Thursday, May 11th, James Charbonnier, as always, beside Sportsnet.ca's chief football writer, John Molinaro. Hello, J-Mo.
Hello.
What the hell was that, man?
I don't know, I thought I'd throw it out.
It's the first time you've ever mocked me.
I know.
About time.
Yes, it's long overdue.
Hello, God blimey, governor.
I don't know why it popped into my head to do that.
Maybe I'll jump into my fake Italian.
There you go.
Now, that'd be really offensive.
Yeah, that would really be offensive.
we're very much obviously in the stretch run of the European season. It's a really big week in the football world. On Friday, we anticipate Chelsea will win the Premier League, playing West Brom, a win, and they're champions. We've already seen a couple of decent games in the Champions League. We know now the finalists will be Juventus, your Juventus.
Mm-hmm.
And Real Madrid. So a lot to get to today. Later in the show, we'll talk to the first ever employee of Toronto FC and the first ever employee of the Canadian Premier League, Paul Byrne, about what exactly is going on with the CPL. It was ratified last week officially by the CSA. It's going to happen. Kickoff likely in 2018, but really officially 2019 is what they're saying. What that means, I don't know. We're going to find out from Paul. We're also going to touch base from Spain with Adrian Bradbury of Football for Good, a good friend of the show. He's got some of his kids from Uganda actually over right now in Spain with Mallorca, taking in the professional environment. So a grassroots look at football as well. But to start with, Jamie, let's talk Champions League, shall we?
Mm.
We're down to that final, Juve-Real Madrid. In the end for Juventus against Monaco, it was a workmanlike, it was a good performance. They did the hard work in the first leg. Were you impressed by the way they put aside Monaco overall?
I think so. I mean, this is a very talented Monaco side, the highest scoring club in European football this year. So, you know, they're brimming with talent, not just Radamel Falcao, but people like Mbappe and Bakayoko and Lamar. This is a very good young side that I think if they can somehow stay together and not get picked off one by one during the summer transfer market, then this is going to be a solid side for years to come. And full credit to Monaco, too, because I don't think many people expected them to get to this point, to be this competitive, you know, beating a club like Manchester City and Borussia Dortmund in the knockout round, playing Juventus somewhat close and poised to win the Ligue 1 title, which, you know, considering PSG's resources, that's not to be sniffed at. So, you know, you have to applaud Monaco for the way that they battled and got to this point. I thought they were brilliant. Just they're not on the same level as Juventus, who, you know, I think at the moment are probably the best team in the world, although I'm somewhat biased on that score.
Well, I think I agree with you. Absolutely. The most complete team, for sure.
Yeah.
I mean, it was never really in doubt, was it?
No, I don't think so.
These two legs.
Yeah.
And I don't think I've ever felt as confident in a team beating a Real Madrid in the final as I do right now with Juventus. You know, obviously it's going to be a battle and I'm not dismissing Real at all, but I look at this Juventus team and there just is not a weakness, including in depth. They could get a couple of injuries anywhere really,
mm-hmm.
and they're covered. Max Allegri, when he first took over, it was to lukewarm applause from Juve fans, obviously. You know, they loved Antonio Conte. He did a great job. But would you say that Allegri's Juventus is better than Conte's Juventus?
Ooh. There's similarities. I think Conte certainly kind of set the template by which Allegri, not necessarily copied, but worked off of. I don't think it's a mistake that, or it's an accident that, you know, Allegri has now been to two Champions League finals with Juventus where Conte, you know, wasn't able to do that. So, yeah, I mean, listen, I think they certainly benefited from Conte's presence and, you know, what he sort of laid down, the foundation. Whether they're necessarily better, you know, probably, I guess, yeah. But as I said, I don't think you could necessarily have, you know, the current Juventus without, you know, with all the hard work and, you know, what Conte first established during his tenure there.
Yeah, and obviously they spent a lot of money, perhaps more money under Allegri.
Right.
Now, of course, they sold Paul Pogba for a few pounds here and there.
Right.
So, bringing Higuain was very clever.
Yeah.
Dybala is emerging at just the right time as well. But you mentioned they also lose a player like Vidal leaves.
You know,
and how he's reinvented Mandzukic up front. He's playing, out wide often. You know, who'd have thought that? He's done a good job there, but AC Milan, I don't think he was ever fully respected, was he, Allegri?
At AC Milan?
Yeah,
or
AC Milan.
I think there was always this kind of appreciation for him, but at the same time, well, you know, who is this guy? I mean, he coached at Cagliari. He never really was like a big name sort of coach.
But it's also during a weird time at AC Milan where they were still considered a giant of the world game.
Right.
And still had memories of being a very good team.
Sure.
With those great players.
Yeah.
But now if you look at what's happened to AC Milan since, I don't know what they are these days.
Right.
Right? You know, and obviously I think he was trying to operate in the shadow of some very big names at that club at the time.
Absolutely. And it's interesting you point that out. While AC Milan is kind of flatlined, his stock, Allegri's, has kind of skyrocketed, right? To the point where he's even been linked with the job to Arsenal and several other teams.
Would that be a step up?
Yeah, no, I think it would be a step down. Let's be perfectly honest.
You're an Arsenal fan, I should mention.
Let's be perfectly
honest. As well as a Juventus fan.
Yeah, it would be a step down, no question about it.
Why is that?
Because Juventus is right now the best club in the world, so going down to Arsenal would be a step down. Seems pretty obvious to me. With all due respect to Arsenal.
Yeah, no, absolutely. But look at your... Can he turn down that job, though? I mean, he said before that he does see himself, you know, being a bit of a globetrotter eventually, and he wants to coach in England. If that job, I'm not saying it will, because we'll discuss Arsenal in a little bit, but you know, that job, if it becomes available, is still a massive opportunity for any football manager. Mm-hmm. You're in London, in the most watched league in the world, a packed stadium, a great stadium, apparently lots of money. We'll see about that.
Right.
It'll be hard for him to say no, though, wouldn't it? If his ambitions lies in England?
Yes and no. I mean, it'd certainly be a great opportunity, but then you have to look at it too. Do you want to be the guy who replaces Arsene Wenger? I think about, you know, what Moyes did, you know, in replacing Sir Alex Ferguson. And it seemed to me he was just kind of, maybe they heralded him at the time as this is the great successor, but it seemed like they were just kind of biding their time till they get Jose, right? And, you know, obviously they went with LVG after that. So,
but there, he was also the replacing the championship winning. So Alex Ferguson, defending champions, right?
Right.
If you're replacing Arsene Wenger, what are you replacing? You're replacing a memory.
Yeah, but he's still, you know, a legend at that club, right? I mean, he's still sort of embedded in the very fabric of that Arsenal side. I don't think you can think of Arsenal without thinking about Arsene Wenger. So I'm not sure that, you know, replacing him directly is that sort of tantalizing of a prospect. Maybe, you know, someone else goes in first and then possibly Allegri. That might be more... you know, appeasing to him. But
What if Allegri wins the treble this year? Only one way to go, Juventus at that point.
Yeah, well, you know, you do it again next year, right? I mean, I don't know. I can't speak for him. I don't know what he's thinking. But, you know, he's got a very good thing going at Juventus right now. And there's something to be said, too, for, you know, sticking... you know, with a good thing and remaining loyal to a team that has kind of remained loyal to you. I know that's kind of crazy in the modern football world, but, you know, I think, as I said, his stock has definitely risen since his time at Juventus. He's very well-respected now. I think he's, you know, considered one of the best coaches in the world. And, you know, would he want to sort of necessarily screw that up? I mean, yeah, okay, if he wins the treble this year, then it's job done. And, you know, what else can you do? Well, win another treble. There's always more to win.
Here's one for you. What if he could bring one player from Juventus to his new club, wherever it is? Say he leaves Juventus this year, next year. He could bring one player from Juventus to his new club. Who would that be?
I would think he would probably bring Paulo Dybala, just because, you know, at 22, 23, such a young player that could be the foundation of that club for the next 10 years, right? I think he's really, since coming over from Palermo 2 years ago, you know, I don't use the word world-class very often because I don't think it applies, but I think he's become one of the few world-class players in the world. You know, he's just, you know, been sensational since coming to Juventus. His game has really improved and he's really emerged as, you know, one of the top talents in the world. So, you know, in an ideal world, if he could bring any one player with him, I suspect it would be Paulo Dybala.
So Juve playing Real Madrid, who put away Atletico in the end. Atletico playing their last European game at the Codron Stadium. Emotional, and what a great stadium that has been over the years.
You know what I found out for the first time? There's a motorway running underneath the stand.
Is it really?
Yeah, I saw that on television yesterday. So the one of the stands kind of backs on to the river, right? And there's basically like a motorway. So the cars, you can see
tunnel.
Yeah, the tunnel. It tunnels basically underneath the stand.
Really?
Yeah.
See, that's what TFC should have done. They're so close to the Gardiner, right? They could have done that. They blew it. Whoever designed the BMO Field, that was your opportunity to have a motorway going under the stadium.
But it was weird. It was like, you know, I've been watching games of the Calderon on television all these years, and it just dawned on me. It was like, oh, wow, that's unusual. It was like the car's actually going under the stadium.
That is very cool.
So there you go.
For what, 20, 25 minutes, we had a real game in our hands, didn't we?
Yeah.
I thought they were great. In fact, they were great throughout that one. And they lose so rarely at home, Atletico, and they won again, but it wasn't enough. Beaten by, well, among others, that wonderful, wonderful play by Karim Benzema.
Fantastic.
The one Real Madrid goal. I mean, I know Simeone must have been going absolutely bananas on the sidelines, you know, seeing Benzema beat three defenders, but what a play that was.
It was, yeah. It was a fantastic piece of skill and individual brilliance. I think you're quite right. Simeone is probably, you know, didn't have a very good night's sleep, especially seeing Godin kind of like stream in there, totally overcommitted, and there was no need to. He shouldn't have played the man. He should have played the space.
I thought Godin was washed up about 3 years ago.
Yeah, well,
man, he stuck with it, eh?
He did, yeah. That performance, that sort of instance notwithstanding, I think he's still one of the best defenders in the world. But, you know, full credit to Real. I mean, at 2-0 down, you thought, okay, game on, and Atletico has all the momentum, and, you know, the easiest thing in the world for them would have been to sort of collapse, but they didn't. They kind of dug in and settled in, and I thought Isco, you know, as the game wore on,
he's
was
really
fantastic.
Emerged, isn't he, as a key player.
Yeah, and the question I ask now is, like, if Bale is ready in 3 weeks, do you bring in Bale over Isco?
Zidane says that he will play in the final if he's healthy. He
Bale.
Says that, yeah.
Well,
we are better with Bale.
I don't
know. Could be argued that systems would suggest that you're not as good against a Juventus team, too. It's going to be a low-scoring game.
Yeah.
It's going to be a grinding type of match, isn't it, against Juventus, I think.
I would think so, yeah.
So maybe this system works better.
Hard to leave out a player of Isco's caliber, especially the way he's playing right now. So,
I'd leave out an £80 million player, too.
That's true, too. But, you know, for me, I've always said, I mean, I don't care about, like, the price tag. I go with whoever's in form at the moment. And, you know, Isco has been sensational the last few weeks.
Is it Dan? A good manager? Can we say that now? It's so hard to judge managers of these kind of teams, isn't it? But you look at this track record. It's pretty damn good.
Sure.
Better than Rafa Benitez, who's the far more decorated manager.
Yeah, I think he's a good manager. Would I necessarily say he's one of the best in the world right now? I mean, I don't know. It's an interesting question. Look, it's not the easiest thing in the world. I know it sounds like, oh, well, he's got Ronaldo and he's got Bale and he has all this world-class talent. And you know, of course he can build a winning team, but it's not always that simple, right? I mean, if money and sort of resources was the end all and be all, then, you know, teams like Manchester City would be winning, the Premier League every year, but they're not. Now, other rich teams are, but
there are not too many average, not very rich teams winning championships apart from Leicester, of course.
Right. So, but I mean, my point is that, you know, I don't think necessarily like money and kind of the resources that clubs like these have available to them necessarily translate into success. So, I mean, it does take some sort of skill to an acumen managerial wise to sort of bring all these diverse group of players together and get them playing into a system and buying into the system, which is kind of what Allegri has done, which is why I think he's done such a great job at Juventus. So it's, I would classify Zidane as a good coach.
Yeah. Tough, place to be, isn't it, though?
Very tough.
Sidelines for those kind of teams because you're never given the credit.
Right.
Only when it goes bad are you criticized.
Sure, right? Absolutely.
Yeah, it's tough. Well, let's switch gears now. Although we'll stay in Spain via Uganda. And our good friend, Adrian Bradbury of Football for Good, joins us. Adrian, how you doing, pal?
I'm good. Spain via Uganda. You don't say that every day.
Not very often, no. But hopefully you'll be saying it more often in the coming months and years if everything goes to plan. Football for Good, we've discussed it numerous times on the show, an academy in Uganda. Now, the plan is eventually, of course, to try and produce players and people that perhaps can make careers of the game overseas. Right now you're in Spain. You're embedded with Mallorca for 2 weeks with four of your players, correct?
That's right.
So tell me the reasons for this. Is it purely footballing or is it to give these kids a real grasp of life outside Uganda?
Yeah, it's certainly football first. But everything that we do, and you mentioned, with the academy in Uganda, it's It's about football. It's about academics. It's about their character. And so we're gaining a lot on the pitch here in regards to the setup of the academy and how professional it is and the quality of the kids. We're also getting a taste of kind of what it would be like to be in an environment like this full time. And while it's only four boys, it's given us our first taste of Europe for the academy. We've also, you know, we had a good chance to visit the new Rafa Nadal Academy here as well on the tennis side, and they have a American international school, so we've been able to see what that's like. And when we talk to the kids about their future, it is football and it's also in the classroom, so they're getting a look at what it takes there if they want to play pro or if they want to go on to NCAA and kind of other pathways as well.
How did this come about, Adrian? Was this you reaching out to Mallorca? How did the deal come about, so to speak?
Yeah, so I've been reaching out to a ton of clubs. With Mallorca, I've been lucky enough, the link actually came through Steve Nash. I know Steve, and we've done some work in the past with my advocacy and whatnot in Uganda, and Steve was part of the new ownership group along with Robert Sarver, the Phoenix Suns, who took control of Mallorca about 2 years back. And so when that happened, we had a conversation about our project in Uganda, and so I had a visit here maybe 8 months ago and spent a day with the new chairman and the group here to kind of seed the idea, and then took the time to pull this trip together.
Now, you have four boys, as mentioned, one from each age group, is that correct?
Yeah, we brought a variety of kids. We thought it'd be good exposure for our boys. At the same time, we wanted to give Mallorca an opportunity to see in just 2 years kind of what level we're at and kind of how far we've come, and I guess also what the potential of what we're doing.
So tell us about their thoughts, the boys, obviously, you know, playing Uganda, that they're their lives, and now suddenly they're in this professional, I mean, listen, Football for Good is a professional setup, but now they're in this top, yeah, top club, one of the big clubs in world football, and suddenly, you know, yeah, how are they enjoying this?
Yeah, they're really enjoying it. It's amazing. Like, we had one of our boys hadn't even been to the capital city of Uganda before we went for visa interviews, to give you an idea of, you know, how big of a trip this is. At the same time, you know, on a plane for the first time, completely unfazed, all the travel. So there's a real confidence and a composure in the kids that's amazing. They're a little nervous on the field for the first time, but they've, you know, once you put the ball in the field, and yeah, the pitches are a lot nicer, but you know, everything else is the same in so many ways. And so they've adjusted well. It's been good that for this first visit, we've been here 2 weeks. I think 1 week would have been too short to allow the boys to get adjusted to weather. It's funny to say we're going to Palma and it's too cold for them, but that's the reality. So adjusting to that a little bit, and food, and obviously language has been an adjustment for them. So there's been a lot of new things, but we're very pleased with how the boys have done. And Mallorca has been very impressed with the quality of our kids, considering the first time we've ever done this.
Well, and more to that, Adrian, how well have you and the boys been sort of welcomed and, you know, just treated by the folks at Mallorca since your time there?
No, it's been amazing. Very welcoming. Like, we're very lucky to have, I have the relationship with Steve, which made the introduction. And then Maheta Malongo, is the chairman here. He's from Democratic Republic of Congo, but spent most of his life in Europe, his childhood. And so he has a real sense of where these kids come from, and that makes a big difference. So they've been very welcoming. Obviously, language is a challenge, and, you know, if this partnership goes further and continues to grow, then I may even have to get in the classroom as well and brush up on my Spanish. But all in all, it's been fantastic, and they've really embraced the boys, both the academy kids and all the coaches.
We're talking to Adrian Bradbury of Football for Good Academy in Uganda. Adrian, you make it very clear that this is not a charity. The plan is to make it a sustainable business. In that, how important is it to get your brand out there across Europe and showing these clubs that, yeah, you're more than just a, you know, an upstart charity?
No, it's vital. Like, I think four boys is one thing. Like, it's really in the next year or two, we want to be able to showcase teams when we're comfortable and we're at a place where we feel like we've come far enough to be able to do that well. But yeah, no, it's, there is a really strong give back element because of where the boys come from, because of the community in northern Uganda and where things are. But yeah, you're absolutely right. And that's why we made this trip. We talked a lot about the opportunity in Uganda and in East Africa, but it's not real until you see the kids in the environment. And for the most part, the coaches have been very impressed. Like, the kids are clearly at the level. A couple of our boys have done very, very well. And so I think there's going to be real interest and an opportunity for us to grow the partnership here.
And how would that, in terms of that growing the partnership, what form would that, how would that manifest itself? What form would that take, do you think?
Yeah, it's a good question. It's something we have to figure out along the way. I think initially we look really closely at some longer exchanges, both with Mallorca coming to see us and with Football for Good coming here to Spain. So whether it's 2 or 3 months at a time to be able to have the boys in the environment in a longer term and have them more properly evaluated, and also to get coaches and staff from Mallorca in our environment to help with identification and to James, to your question around building our brand, I think it's just as important for us to have Mallorca or the clubs that we work with to be in Uganda and in East Africa, because that also increases the understanding or seriousness of what it is we're doing and how far along we are. And so when it comes to identification and building partnerships at home in Uganda, that's vital as well. So I think it's kind of baby steps along the way with some visits and training placements and then hopefully growing from there.
That's interesting. I mean, you really are one of a kind in Uganda. And I've read some Ugandan, media stories, and they speak very highly of what Football for Good is. But I wonder, you're sending players to Spain now. You've been in North America before. How are you seen by other Ugandan clubs? Is there an element of envy there?
Not really. I think that's more curiosity than anything right now. It's funny, some of the stuff that you'd read around the trip to Spain, we've been getting a lot of messages since that hit. And so there are a lot of people who run quote-unquote academies in Uganda and in East Africa. They're not necessarily full-time or residential. They don't have as professional setup as we do and don't have pathways for the boys. So I think there is interest in building bridges and partnerships with what we're doing from other local academies and clubs and for us to find a way to do that together. I think that's something that's really lacking. There is a very little opportunity for youth and youth development in the region. And so in general, it's been really, really good. And so hopefully we can use this trip and the publicity to talk to more clubs and more academies. Like, as an example, our U14 group is in Kampala this week, playing a bunch of friendlies with clubs and academies down there, building bridges and trying to link with folks across the country. And from what I've been hearing from my kind of head of coaching, Harry Varley, that it's been going very, very well.
Now, you've been there, almost 2 years now? Is it 2 years?
Yeah, we're into year three.
Year three, wow, already. Now, your plan, I think, originally was to do 2 years and then come home, wasn't it?
Sorry?
Your plan originally was to do 2 years and then come home. Wasn't that the original plan?
Well, I think the original conversation was, we'll be there for 18 months, and then what happens after that is up in the air.
Right. Now you mentioned, obviously, it's been an adjustment for your family, obviously, but you're still there. Are the family loving it now?
No, they're really enjoying it. Like, so the four boys here, my youngest son, Owen, who's 13, is here with us in Palma and really enjoying it. So the environment in Uganda is one thing, and the chance to be a part of these trips is another. It's going well. My wife Kim is getting more and more involved in the classroom academically with our boys. She's a teacher at home in Canada, and so she's being a big part of that. And then my oldest son Isaac is kind of a year or two away from university, so he's starting to think NCAA is a pathway. And so we've been talking about kind of other kind of prep school or academic opportunities for him so he can get seen and take advantage of that, which is not an easy thing to do from Gulu, northern Uganda. So we're having to find creative ways to do that for him. But no, they've really enjoyed it. And for, say, a 13-year-old and a 16-year-old boy to get to go to school half a day and do homeschooling and some independent links back home and then play football in the afternoon in 30-degree weather every single day, it's a pretty good deal.
Yeah, no kidding. It's a great football story. It's also a great Canadian story too. Adrian, once again, as always, please tell the audience here how they can find out more about Football for Good.
Sure, yeah. So the best would be to start at the website, which is football-4-good.org. And then we're very easy, FFG Academy on Facebook and on Twitter.
Great stuff, Adrian. Thanks so much, mate. Keep enjoying Spain. It must be real tough for you down there, I'm sure. But we'll talk to you real soon.
Yeah, thanks a lot.
That's Adrian Bradbury of Football for Good Academy. We've been following Adrian's story for some time now. And a huge commitment he made, him and his family, moving to Uganda from Toronto. Right now they're taking kids to Mallorca, one of the big clubs in world football.
Yeah.
They've been over here in North America at TFC.
They have,
got contacts around the world. So this place, this it's not a charity. It's a business model. It is hopefully only going one direction.
Yeah, absolutely.
So football's doing very well on the ground in Uganda, but also here in Canada, it was a huge weekend last weekend. The CSA officially ratified the Canadian Premier League, JMO, which means very soon domestic professional soccer coming to a marketplace very near you. A big moment.
Yeah, a massive moment. One that we've been anxiously awaiting for a very long time. One that I think we all understand is going to, you know, be massive for the sport in this country in terms of development, and not just of development of players, but also, you know, referees and coaches and administrators and everything. So it's, I think it's a very much a landmark, situation here with the CPL coming to fore.
Now, it may have been the worst kept secret in the history of football over here in Canada, because they actually hired their first employee back in November, I think it was, before it was official and all that. A lot of speculation since then. And that man is a name familiar with Canadian soccer fans, especially here in Toronto. He was actually the first employee also of Toronto FC. It's Paul Byrne, the project manager of the Canadian Premier League. How does that sound? Sounds pretty good to me. Paul, welcome back to these shores after some time on the south coast of England at Brighton. You were hired back in, I think, November. It was ratified this past weekend. What have you been doing?
That's job done. I'm just going to go home and take a nap. it's been a bit of a whirlwind, and I have to say, the job didn't start in November. It started about 3 years ago. In fact, before I got on a plane to go to Brighton, I had a beer with Scott Mitchell, and he was already cooking up this plan for a Canadian soccer league. And what has really made it possible to come to fruition is a real spirit of cooperation between the CSA and the Canadian Soccer Association, and in particular Victor Montaliani, and Bob Young, who owns the Tiger Cats, and Scott Mitchell, who runs the Tiger Cats for Bob. Those three guys have really managed to come up with a business opportunity and a soccer opportunity wherein everybody's interests are aligned. And so now we have a league owned by a bunch of people who know that as the men's national team improves on the global scale, so does the opportunity for our league. So it's a real watershed moment.
So what now, Paul? The plan for the CPL has been approved. What's the next step? Where do we go from here? What are sort of the small and big steps that you have to take before the a ball is kicked?
In the not too distant future, we will need to announce who's playing in our first year and what our first year looked like. And so as it sits right now, we've received 10 expressions of interest from coast to coast. Two of those we're bullish on, and that is Hamilton and Winnipeg. And so they actually also applied for professional status under the CSA and were unanimously approved at the annual general meeting. So we have two teams, but we in the next 90 days or so, we will do our due diligence on the remaining eight and find out who's going to be in our league and when they're going to come into our league. As you might imagine, there's not a lot of great facilities across this country. And so building soccer-specific stadiums is all part of this plan as well, and those take time. So I suspect, if I was a betting man, and I'm not, I would say we start with six or seven teams at the outset, and then we work our way up to 10, 12, 14 over the next 10 or so years. And since the announcement on the weekend, we've received three more.
Wow.
Not real expressions of interest, because an expression of interest entails a whole bunch of business background and financials and so on, but I would say serious inquiries. Lots of inquiries, three real serious ones. And so we're really bullish on our future growth.
And the timeline here is to what, launch officially next year with the first season?
Uh, Yeah, we haven't actually stated a timeline, but we're thinking that launching in the shadow of the World Cup, after the World Cup, might be a wise idea. But we're not holding ourselves to that. We still got a lot of work to do before we state a start date.
I think clearly that this country needs a professional league to make that next step, to really nurture and encourage it, and you know, get the next level of player in this country and provide that pathway to who knows where. But the cynic in me says, is a league sustainable in this country? Is the thirst for soccer outside the big markets there? You've obviously studied this a lot more than I have, Paul. You're obviously confident that, in fact, this is potentially a league that can be sustainable?
Absolutely. I don't mind saying what I'm going through right now feels a lot like the planning for an MLS team in Toronto in 2005 and 2006. So before the launch of Toronto FC, people were asking me that, and they didn't have that little caveat outside of the major cities. You know, it was people were skeptical about the sport in this country. And the thing I always remind people is that the demographics of this country today are very different than they were in 1986. And the cost of travel is very different than it was. And the participation in the game and the people's habits and, you know, how they watch TV or cord cutters and, you know, going out and spending time outdoors is a completely different landscape than it was 30 years ago. And all signs point to this being not only a very successful launch, but it'll feel like it was overdue. Like, why were we doubtful, you know? And so I'm very, very bullish on it.
What are some of the challenges, Paul? I mean, you're starting from scratch. It sounds like the league has, you know, big ambitions to be in several, you know, markets across the country. What are some of the obstacles that need to be overcome here?
Well, first is James Sharman's skepticism, and then
I said the cynic in me. It wasn't the dominant part.
It's about managing people's expectations, and that's both on the player side and the, you know, within the soccer world, as well as the fan side. We do have high hopes, but we've had to, create I'm going to bore people with the business side of it, but we've had to create an environment where our owners can be successful with a very modest gate. And so that's great, because that means that they can make money if they sell a lot of tickets. But it also means that, I know you guys know, you've been to many football or soccer events. I can call it football on your show, right?
Yeah, of either course. One's good, man. Either one's fine.
You guys have been to many football events, and the night out is a lot better if the place is full. And so that's what we're going to focus on. We're going to make sure that to the extent that we can, that our facilities are the right size for those markets, and that the atmosphere has an opportunity to really really exist and to grow. Football is part of a night out, but it's not the whole thing. The night out is the time with your friends and having a few pints and enjoying the game. And I hesitate to say we're creating a product and sort of, you know, that American ideal of fireworks and cheerleaders, but we do have to be cognizant of the event that people are going to participate in, and so we're really focusing on that.
As you know, Paul, professional sports teams can be very suspicious of new things, new ideas, new leagues. How have your ideas been met by Major League Soccer, Toronto FC, Vancouver Whitecaps, and Montreal Impact?
It's been interesting. You know, there's lots of ways in which we can coexist and be mutually supportive. But you're right. Sometimes there's more questions than answers, and we are in a phase of our development where they probably feel that way, that there's more questions than answers. Now, having said that, we're communicating with them more frequently than anybody else, and we certainly have a desire. You know, we all recognize that we have the same interests at heart. At our core, it's about the development of the player, and their Canadian teams and their investment in Canadian players has been second to none. And so it's really just an opportunity for us to find ways to work together. The key reason that we've been very cautious in terms of being too eager to engage in an official way with those teams is that we want our league to have an opportunity to stand up on its own 2 feet and have a good, strong foundation and not to be perceived as or to actually be a development league for a different league. You know, we want the Canadian Premier League to be Canada's top tier, and we don't want to just compare ourselves to the American League. We want to compare ourselves to leagues all around the world, and we aspire to start at a certain level and then to grow and to improve over time. And, you know, I think in 10 years, this will be a very strong league with a really strong, you know, there's the football development foundations in this country are unbelievably strong, and we're just going to help fill up the top of the pyramid. And I think that bodes well for the quality of play in our country.
Just playing devil's advocate here, Paul, because that's what I like to do. You know, when you look at a team like TFC, obviously run by MLSC, which I don't have to tell you, former MLSC employee, you know, they've been pretty successful, although maybe not necessarily on the pitch all the time. But, you know, in terms of launching sports teams and being commercial successes. So just as, again, playing devil's advocate, I wouldn't you guys want to be anxious to tap into that sort of expertise? Do you know what I mean?
Absolutely, and that's why I'm saying we're talking to them every single day, or it feels like every day, but certainly very, very frequently. I was with Bill Manning and Tim out at Whistler, and Bob Leonarduzzi and his team were there as well, and that was just our most recent conversation. So yes, we're talking to them very frequently, and like I said, our concern only has to do with being an independent and strong national league.
Sorry about that. And further to that, because as you can aware, this is kind of blown up on Twitter and social media, and people are already talking about what is the CPL and how are they going to, you know, go against MLS, and this is going to be, you know, a second rate league, and, you know, they're not going to be able to attract, you know, top talent and whatnot. You know, what do you make of all the sort of chatter about all this, about, you know, the quality of the league and what it's going to be before a ball has even been kicked?
Well, first off, John, I've got my ear to the ground better than most, and what you just described is not what I'm seeing on social media. I'm seeing one or two MLS fans who are being quite aggressive in their defense of the quality of MLS, and that's fine. I mean, they're sport fans. That's, having strong opinions is part of being a sport fan. But I'm not seeing any kind of negativity, really, or even skepticism around this. I all I'm seeing is lots of enthusiasm, the enthusiasm is great because it's coming from soccer quarters, but it's also great because it's coming from people that I've not come across in the game before, and mainstream and coast to coast, and in small communities as well as big ones. So there's nothing that I'm seeing or hearing in the chatter that gives me any pause at all. It only emboldens me and you know, the owners that we're working with. So I'm sorry, but I don't see it.
Okay, no, that's fair enough. And I guess you kind of talked about it there. You know, you left Brighton to come to do this, you know, a very important job. Maybe you can just explain why. I mean, that's, you know, a pretty bold move, and you know, some would argue. Why did you feel compelled to do this?
Well, it's you know, as somebody who's worked in sports for 25 years, there's something about the game of soccer that has really just gotten into my skin. You know, I on the one hand, I'm very proud of what I and my team were able to achieve with Toronto FC when we launched it. But on the other hand, I'm ashamed to say I had never seen a professional soccer game until the year before TFC started. So in some ways, I come to the game as a newcomer. I've been in it for 10 years, and I've worked in England, and that's all great. But I'm telling you that the magic of this game and the qualities that this game, the positive impact it can have on our community, and I've seen it here in Toronto, and I've seen it in England. It's magical, and so really, I'm just excited about being able to have a similar impact in all these different communities across the country. To me, that's just a huge privilege to be able to have some sort of impact like that.
You know, Paul, you spent a couple of years, as you mentioned there, in Brighton, a smaller footballing market, but a good club that's been operating below top flight football. You've grown into something. You've grown this brand. It's now being promoted to the top flight. I see some comparisons here. How useful has that experience been, do you think, looking ahead to your future?
I think you said it there in your question. It's a smaller market, and if I had gone there straight from Toronto FC, I don't think I would have had as good a time. I think it was great that so between Toronto FC and Brighton, I spent a year in Ottawa with the Senators, and that market is, you know, in size and scope is very similar to Brighton, just in terms of numbers. There's a lot of differences as well. But it was really helpful for me to work in a smaller market and understand the dynamics of those two smaller markets, Ottawa and Brighton. And I think I think that'll help me as I start to engage in some of the smaller cities around Canada.
Paul, before you leave us, I've got to mention it. Just kind of made sense to me. You leave TFC, right? And they go into the finals. You leave Ottawa, and they make the conference finals. And you leave Brighton.
James, I think you're going under a bridge. yes, there's a pattern there. That's why I'm getting out of the team business.
And Brighton is now promoted. Yeah. I'm having fun with you, mate. Listen, I'm fascinated to see how this works out. I really hope it works out. And you've been there, you've done it. You've got great experience now. And people like yourself involved, I'm sure it will be successful. So thanks for joining us, Paul. And I hope you can join us again in the weeks and months and years.
I would definitely love to come on again in the future. And just a quick comment, you know, part of what really excites me about this is not just about the football outcomes, but also about the sports business outcomes. We're creating a whole industry here for, as you said, coaches and administrators and officials from top to bottom. You know, if in 10 years we've got a bunch of head coaches in our league who have played for the national team, and we've shown that there's a continuum, there's a place for national team players to move to and to continue their careers. To me, that would be a very rewarding picture of success.
Absolutely. Thanks so much, Paul. Chat soon.
Okay, thanks, guys. Bye.
Cheers, Paul.
That is Paul Byrne, the new Canadian Premier League's project manager. It is upon us, people. It's going to be a real thing. And it's an exciting time, I think, to be a fan of the sport in this country. We may even have World Cup games by 2026.
Yeah.
It's been actually announced today. They have expedited the process. So potentially we could find out whether that bid wins or whether there's any opponents to that bid as early as this time next year, they're saying.
Yeah.
So start planning the games.
Yeah, massive.
I say.
Yeah, massive.
Let us know whether there's automatic berths.
Yeah, well, that's the big one, right, for me. I mean, you know, I expect that this North American bid is fully going to be successful and no one else will come forward and it'll be granted. But for me, the big question is, you know, Canada's route. Does it get in as an automatic berth as a co-host, or does it actually have to qualify? So that'll be really interesting.
And by then, there's going to be 7 or 8 years of Canadian Premier League football too to help foster talent in this country. And it is, I mean, like I said, I'm a bit of a cynic by nature. I don't know how successful it's going to be. I have fingers crossed. And then I mentioned Paul's been there. He's done it. He's experienced. There's good people involved. Let's hope it works.
Yeah, absolutely.
It's going to be something pretty special, I think, for this country and these football markets outside the big markets.
Yeah, absolutely. If you can get into places like Halifax and
Winnipeg,
and kind of Hamilton, these secondary markets. I don't mean secondary and derogatory, but they're not kind of big cities.
And it will make a potential Canadian championship really interesting.
Absolutely, yeah.
And legitimate as well.
Yeah, absolutely. And I just, again, it just gives lots of opportunities to players and coaches and referees and administrators. And it's kind of like I said earlier on the show, and Paul kind of reiterated, it's you're kind of building this kind of industry of professionals in the soccer world in Canada. So that can only be a good thing.
All part of the growth, isn't it?
Absolutely.
We should mention before we leave you, TFC last night, they won their 5th straight game.
Yeah.
And so club record, is it not?
Never won 5 MLS games in a row before. So the first place in MLS and first place in the Eastern Conference.
And they're doing it with a cast of B-teamers.
Well, I don't know, B-teamers, but their depth is certainly...
You know what I'm saying, though? The depth is... Yeah. You've written about it all week and last week as well on sportsnet.ca. It's so on show right now.
Yeah.
And you're seeing it across the world these days, how important depth is. You can't rely on your top 11.
Right.
You just can't. There's too many games.
No, absolutely.
And we've seen some people emerge, you know, without Sebastian Giovinco, this team's grinding out results.
Yeah. I mean, when you look at players the caliber of You know, I think Victor Vasquez has just been an incredible pickup.
How many assists now?
I want to say 7 or 8. And the one he made yesterday on the winning goal, I don't know if you saw it.
Oh, no, no, it's incredible.
Oh, my God.
He could have 20 assists by the end of the season.
He is just a phenomenal player. So he's been great. But then you also have guys like Raheem Edwards and Jay Chapman. And
Maki Delgado.
Raheem Delgado and Benoit Cheyroux, who came in last game and, you know, was brilliant over 90 minutes. So, yeah, it's a grueling schedule that they're in too, right? Because they played last Wednesday. Then they played Saturday in Seattle. Played yesterday in Columbus. They're going to play again in Minnesota. So that's 4 games in, you know, in a short period of time.
And, it's worse than Manchester United.
Yeah, well, there you go.
Jose Mourinho whines about that enough, doesn't he?
Exactly. So, you know, full credit to the Reds. I mean, they're, you know, the top team in Toronto sports right now, which I take a great deal of glee in. So.
Anything you want to add to that, J-Mo?
No, I think okay. We all understand what I'm saying.
Okay, fair enough. As mentioned earlier, we're in the stretch run. 2 games left or 3 games, depending who you are. In the Premier League, Chelsea could be champions by Saturday morning. They play West Bromwich Albion on Friday. Likely they're going to win that the way they're playing right now, and will be crowned champions. So on Saturday, our games are as follows. 9:30 a.m. in Sportsnet 1. We have Middlesbrough, who are already down, against Southampton. The late one, though, Stoke against Arsenal. Those 2 old foes.
Yeah.
Also on Sportsnet 1. The Gunners having come off a couple of better results. And now...
Yep.
Listen, I don't think they're going to finish top 4.
No, neither do
I. But there's a conversation to be had, thankfully. A bit of drama maybe going down to the final 2 games. On Sunday, we have Crystal Palace Hull. That is suddenly
That's a really big
game.
That's huge.
6 a.m. Eastern. Get up for it, people. It's worth it. We have West Ham Liverpool. If Liverpool win out the last 2 games, they play Champions League football. Mm. This is the kind of game that just terrifies me.
Right.
Not happy about it.
The Forest Sherman Derby, as I call it.
Exactly. That's also in Sportsnet World. And then the late one, 11 a.m. Eastern, Spurs, Manchester United.
Ooh.
That's a gorgeous matchup. Always goals in that one.
The last game at White Hart Lane, correct?
Yes, it is. Yeah, right. I mean, we'll address that on Saturday's show with Craig and Danny, I'm sure, of many a memory. I'm sure Danny was sent off at some point at White Hart Lane. I'm sure Craig was blown out at some point at White Hart Lane.
Yeah, probably.
So nothing against Craig.
Right, yeah.
So, yeah, please join us this weekend in the Prem. So, yeah, that's about it for the show. Hope you enjoyed that, everyone. Thanks to Paul Byrne and to Adrian Bradbury. And, of course, to you, J-Mo, and Eric Prime behind the glass. Anything of note this weekend on .ca?
Just the usual. A lot of Premier League coverage, a lot of TFC coverage, some Montreal Impact coverage. We're actually going to have a reporter at the Stoke-Arsenal game, Richard Buxton, so he'll file kind of a post-match analysis. So.
Breaking down the various scything tackles.
Exactly. And, yeah. So, yeah, lots of stuff.
All right, we're done. Hope you enjoyed that. We'll speak to you next week. Cheers for listening.